This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DiFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 119 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. I greatly appreciate it. Really excited for today's guest, fellow New Jerseyan, someone that I connected with when I was doing my presentation for the NSCA New Jersey Conference back in May. You know, basically reached out. He presented as well. We both presented at the conference. It was via Zoom. So I did get to know a lot of the presenters from that conference, which is really cool. But basically reached out, you know, wanted to connect just to, you know, kind of talk shop and you know, being in the same state, it is nice to make connections with other strength coaches. And I got to know Angelo, you know, a little bit about his background. He's been a strength and conditioning coach at Seton Hall University in East Orange, New Jersey, since 2005, primarily working with the basketball and baseball teams. And if you don't know much about Seton Hall, those are two of the best programs they have at, you know, the university. High level program. Seton Hall basketball has been a top 20 program for the past like 5 or 6 years. They've made some deep runs into the tournament, recently. I think they went 2 or 3 rounds into the tournament, last year or the year before. They were a top 10 team this year before COVID hit. You know, would have been primed for a deep run, probably a 2 or 3 seed. So it was a shame that that didn't happen, but, you know, won the Big East, once or twice in the last five, 6 years, you know, have competed well at Villanova, who's won a couple national championships. So anyway, really high level program that Angelo gets to work with. And he also works with their baseball program, who I've known a lot of players who've played for them. I know the coaching staff. I used to actually go to camps, at the university when I was younger, run by the Shepherd family, a great baseball family in New Jersey. So it was really cool to kind of talk to Angelo. And right after we spoke for the first time, I knew he'd be a great guest to have on the show, just to kind of talk shop, what he's been doing at Seton Hall for the better part of the last almost 2 decades. You know, some of the things that he's seen change in the industry, what he's learned, you know, how he preps his baseball players, because I did want to talk about baseball specifically due to the nature of, you know, my audience and you guys who listen and a lot of the questions you have. So, you know, going through a lot of cool stuff like that. We also talked a little bit about recruiting, getting kids, you know, over to Seton Hall, which is kind of hard when you're competing with a lot of out-of-state schools down south, especially, you know, all that good stuff like that. So I really think you guys are going to enjoy this episode. Angelo is a very honest and genuine person, and both of us kind of just sat back and talked shop for a good hour, and I think you guys are going to love it. So really excited to have him on today. Couple notes coming up. This week, obviously, we had Meathead Monday, episode 118, where I talked about a topic that has popped up this past week, a great thread by Zach Dakin from TCU, talking about the difference between a traditional West Side approach, Louis Simmons West Side barbell approach, might not be the best thing for athletes, probably isn't the best thing for athletes. And it really inspired me to want to talk a little bit about some of the things that I've adopted from the West Side approach, but, you know, how it's really different for athletes. And I think that's an important discussion to have, giving a little bit of my insight on how I do that and what really makes it different when you're working with athletes versus powerlifters. So check out Monday's Meathead Monday 118 if you haven't already. It's a great one. Coming up, we will have next week, episode 121, Brendan Thompson. Brendan was an All-American, sprinter at Iowa and now coaches and is also a, recently graduated doctor of physical therapy from Washington University in St. Louis. Great young mind in the industry, holds no punches on social media and just tells it how it is and really stands behind his thoughts and has a lot of smart things to say. So I was really pumped to have him on. So I know you guys are going to love that one. And then the week after, we have registered dietitian Emily Bogato. Emily is a dietitian for, Des Pfeiffer, who's also a guest I'll be having on, the show in a few weeks. And she basically just comes on and just really rips up. Well, I don't want to say rips apart. I don't want to give a negative connotation to it, but dispels some rumors in nutrition and, you know, what people think is reality versus what actually is reality. And, you know, she's around my age. So a young coach, up and coming in the industry, you know, really puts out some good stuff, does a lot of good things, works really hard on the business end, and has a lot of really good info. And I was thrilled to have her on. It was a really fun convo. So I'm looking forward to that as well. So some great things coming up. And before I ramble on too much, let's turn it over to Julian for this week's nutrition tip. And we will be back with this conversation with Angela. Thanks, guys.
What's going on, everybody? Coach Julian here with another nutrition tip of the day. And today, my biggest piece of advice for people during this time period and during this pandemic is don't skip breakfast. You know, I feel like I get this a lot from a lot of my athletes. You know, a lot of the kids are not super hungry when they wake up in the morning. They don't feel like eating a big meal when they wake up. But guess what? Breakfast is a great time to get some vital nutrients necessary to start the day off on a good note. Especially if you're an athlete that has trouble putting on weight or has difficulty hitting their requirements throughout the day in order to maintain whatever goal physique they might have in mind or whatever their performance goals are. You know, a lot of the times the biggest issue comes with breakfast because they tend to skip this meal. If you're an athlete that needs to put on weight or has problems putting on weight, maybe you should consider having breakfast. If you skip breakfast, you're missing an opportunity to fuel your body. And I like to tell people this all the time. If you're underfueling, you're underperforming. So next time, guys, make sure you look into actually having some breakfast, whether it's something small, an actual like physical food, like eggs, oatmeal, whatever the case may be. Or you could just simply go for a shake. You know, having some type of a shake is at least getting something in your body to fuel you. It doesn't have to be super big, doesn't have to be super small. You know, at least getting some fuel in your body can help you start the day out on a nice note. And with that, guys, I'm going to get you back to Jerry with this episode of Muscles and Management.
All right, Jules, thanks again for another great tip. Guys, can't say it enough. Breakfast is a really important meal, especially if you're an athlete who's doing practices, training, things throughout the day. If you're a professional who needs to get up and kind of have energy right off the bat, it's a great foundation to your day. You know, and Julian's tips on how to go about it and not only the importance of it, but what you should be looking at for what you're consuming for breakfast, I think is huge. So thanks, Jules, as always. I'm going to turn it over now to this conversation with Angelo Gingerelli, Seton Hall University strength and conditioning coach. I know you guys are going to love this one. As always, please hit me back with any feedback, questions, concerns, you know, things you'd like me to talk about in future episodes, and I will do my best to get to all of them. Thanks, guys, and enjoy. Peace. All right, everyone. Excited to welcome on Angelo Gingerelli. Angelo, thank you so much for your time. Excited to have you on.
Thanks, man. I love the podcast. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, awesome. So, little background for the listeners. We first, I say met. I mean, in today's day and age, it's pretty normal to say met when you have never actually met somebody in person. But we both presented at this year's New Jersey NSCA conference and basically just connected after that. And I want to say we had one phone conversation, I want to say back in June, kind of just to, you know, touch base and just get to know each other a little bit. And I've been wanting to record this with you for a while because I definitely thought we'd have some cool stuff to talk about. I guess the first kind of question I would have for you to kind of get things rolling for us is just kind of give us a little insight on what you're doing on a day-to-day and what, you know, is involved with that. And we'll kind of go from there.
Okay, cool, man. Right now, I am, and I've been since 2005, so 15 years in an eternity in the college strength and conditioning game. I've been a strength and conditioning coach at Seton Hall University up in South Orange, New Jersey, not that far from your facility. Yep. When I met, we were actually pretty much completely shut down in May and June, and I was kind of working from home, doing some social media stuff for Seton Hall for our student athletes, and then we got back on campus. This is our fourth week back of having some student athletes on and doing some training. We don't know if we're playing games at any point this year. We know the fall season's shut down. We're waiting to hear about the winter and spring sports, but we're training, trying to keep the kids engaged and locked in and, you know, not doing the right things until we know what we're going to do this year and hopefully play sports at some point, whether or not that's in front of a crowd, whether or not that's what that looks like, I have no idea. But yeah, we're trying to train and do the best we can for right now.
Yeah, it's been a whirlwind for everybody, especially like you can relate to this. I always find myself on the kind of the other side explaining to my guests who are from different states kind of what it's been like in New Jersey. We were really shut down for like
I don't what 8 to 10 weeks. Like it was.
Yeah, I mean,
pretty...
if you go back to like the second half of March, April, really into almost Memorial Day, like you know the end of May,
there was nothing going on.
Yeah. It was amazing. Yeah. The kids weren't in school. The colleges were not in school. Restaurants were completely shut down.
Literally, grocery store, and like that was basically it.
It was the grocery store and like the mail trucks and Amazon and UPS were the only things going on. For like you said, probably close to 10 weeks. And then I think once we hit Memorial Day, some stuff started to open. I lived down at the Jersey Shore. And then as the weather got nice, you know, some of the nightlife stuff started to happen. The place that had outside seating started to happen. The beach got super packed because nobody was working or going to school. And then now I'm hoping just economically some of this stuff continues. But it's going to get cold, right? It's starting to get cold now. And, you know, what's outside dining look like in New Jersey in November and December? We've never tried to do that before. So hopefully stuff can get rolling and people can get open and we start, you know, getting this economy going again.
Yeah, I was saying
in a way that's safe. Not saying we should be reckless about it, but in a way that's safe and
yeah,
we can
for sure.
Not have another outbreak and people can keep making money and have a livelihood.
Yeah, I was joking the other day. I was like, man, I want to buy some stock in like a company that does outdoor heaters.
Yeah, man. Yeah, time might be a little late, but about 6 months ago would have been a time to get in on that.
Yeah, I feel like it's been cool, definitely, and especially in this area, to see some of the creativity from different places with the outdoor settings. You know, we only for about a week now have had, you know, indoor dining at even only 25% capacity. But all summer around here, it's been pretty cool to kind of see, you know, the creativity of these places bringing tents and different types of setups outside to keep things going. And I think on the same end, too, it's been interesting and cool to see the creativity, you know, different strength coaches have had, whether they have private facilities or schools, like what people have been able to do to kind of keep things moving with what we've been dealing with. You know, what's that been like now, like as things have started to get rolling a little bit, like what kind of limitations have you had to deal with and what are some ways you kind of tried to work through them with some new solutions?
Cool, man. The biggest limitation I had was my whole world kind of shut down, right? I work in a weight room where we pack it with, you know, we have 40 baseball guys at the time. It was our biggest group at Seton Hall. And then I teach classes on top. I'm an adjunct professor role, so I teach a class every day, which I really like doing. And I recommend for young strength coaches, if you can get that income stream to open up for you and you can, where I always say, like, it's a nice break. Instead of eating lunch, I go to a classroom and for an hour, there's not music blaring, no one's cursing and spitting and, you know, trying to squat the rack or whatever. It's kind of a nice little break for me, and I really like it. But all of that shut down from mid-March until, like we said, right about Memorial Day. So what I did was with the school's backing, I was able to put up some workouts on Instagram. I did a Instagram live workout every Tuesday that I would kind of just call out a workout to one of our staff members. They would do the workout, and I would interact with everybody on the Instagram comments, which I really had fun doing that. And then when we got to the summer, we really just shut it down because the administration's thought was if the kids are normally off in the summer, they're going to be off this summer. And then luckily we were able to open back up at a reduced capacity, kind of like the restaurants were doing now about 3-4 weeks ago, where it's a good and a bad thing, right? The good thing is there's less people in the room at a time. The level of coaching is better because you have, you know, less people to work with at one time. But now, for example, our baseball team's 43 guys right now. So that's got to be 3 different hours in the room because we can't put 43 guys in there at once anymore because of social distancing policies. So it's like it's a double-edged sword, like a lot of things in our profession. We're getting through it. We're making it work. We're trying to keep everybody engaged and motivated. It's been somewhat hard, but the kids have been pretty good about it. The coaches have been cool about it. And we're trying to make it work the best we can.
Yeah, I think that's just, it's been all around. Like, hell, I mentioned, you know, when we first spoke, I was working at a PT place because they had room in the back of the facility outdoors that I could train the kids and they were ready to go. And I was kind of like, all right, we'll make the best of it. You know, that's another thing too, people don't realize, like you work with a sport like basketball, maybe you have like 15 athletes in the college setting, like baseball, the roster, and even football too, like the roster is just so big. It just makes it really tough.
I want to give you credit and a lot of guys like you credit that I saw. One thing I saw from being in the college setting for as long as I have that I am amazed at and thought was awesome during this whole thing is the way you got kids to come out and train in 90 degree heat in August, right? And they would bring the equipment out, crush it for an hour or whatever, you know, and they go back and be happy about it. And that's something I think when you're working a pro with a college setting, you don't always get, you know what I mean? But you got the buy-in level is so high and these kids are so motivated. If you say, all right, we're going to drag the squat rack outside because that's the law and we're going to do, eight sets of heavy squats in 90-degree heat on black asphalt, and they're chomping at the bit to do it, you're doing something right, in my opinion. And I saw so much of that on Instagram this summer. I was just like, man, it's really awesome what a lot of these private sector guys, starting with yourself, are doing to have that kind of belief in the program that these kids are doing that and paying to do it. I think that's awesome, man. So, and I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
I was just saying, like, just the dynamics, I guess, of working with such a large group of athletes. Yeah,
man, it can be challenging. And what I normally try to do is I break it down. So, for example, we got 43 baseball guys, about 20 pitchers, 20, you know, position players. They're doing different workouts. I try to keep them in different parts of the facility at one time. So, for example, what I do with baseball, which is one of probably our best team at Seton Hall over the last decade. So we have eight racks, right? We have a rack area, and then we have a dumbbell section and a bunch of machines. So one day we'll train 4 days a week. Two of the days our position guys are in the racks doing their heavy stuff, right? They're squatting, they're trap bar deadlifting, they're doing clean pulls, that kind of stuff. And the pitchers are in either the dumbbells or the machine section doing their auxiliary work. And the other 2 days we flip-flop that. So what I'll do is I'll put an assistant or an intern in charge of the group doing the auxiliary work, and I'll stay with the rack guys every day to make sure they're doing that right and doing what they have to do. And that's kind of the way I break it down into groups like that. If I have a group of swimmers, maybe I'll put the freshmen and sophomores on the racks one day so I can really watch what they're doing and get the juniors and seniors doing some med ball work, some core stuff, some stuff kind of out of the way that's maybe a little bit safer, a little bit harder to mess up. And then we'll flip that on another day where I can give that group my full attention on something maybe a little more dangerous and a little more technique and coaching intensive. But that's one thing. We have a very nice facility at Seton Hall, particularly for a school without football, but you still have to be creative with the facility and give everybody the attention they deserve. And just try to make that happen every day. The same way, you know, anybody, whether you're in a high school, whether you're training in your garage or, you know, at the University of Alabama, you still got to find a way to make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just said it too, like the facility. For those who don't know who are listening, you know, just to give them an idea of how good of a program Seton Hall baseball is, you know, we're talking Big East. We're talking like won the conference recently. A all around just really, really good program, just to put that out there for the listeners.
Yeah, they are our basketball team's really great the last, let's say, 5 years.
Yeah.
And it's been great to be a part of that. You know, if the world was normal, Miles Powell would most likely be ready to play in the NBA this year, but there was no draft and no tournament, and the world just changed on him, unfortunately, the last time at the worst time in you know, his career. But baseball, man, for the last 10 years, we won the Big East in 2011. Been in the Final Four of the conference, I believe, almost every year since then. We've had about 25 guys drafted. Just a really rock-solid program, particularly in the Big East. We're not in a warm-weather state where the guys can play all year. And I say that at every time I talk about this, I say I'm lucky to be a part of that. I think I'm a very small piece of a puzzle that works from the head coach all the way on down to the student managers. It just works from top to bottom. And at the last conference that I presented at, not 2020, but 2018, so before I met you, I presented on preparing athletes for college athletics, right? So you sign your letter of intent, what do you do the next day? And I kind of use our baseball program as the gold standard, because I think they just recruit kids that are going to work in the system that they have that's proven for them to work. And, you know, if that means maybe getting a kid that's maybe a little less talented, but a good team guy that will play his role and do what he's asked to do, they go after that guy. And they hold everybody accountable. And when they recruit kids, they keep it real. And that's a lot of college. A lot of times, if anybody you listen to train is being recruited, I'm not going to say coaches lie, but they definitely stretch the truth a little bit, right? So, like, you know, you're recruited to play baseball in New Jersey, and the guys are like, yeah, we practice outside from January to May. Well, no, you know, there's snow on the ground in January. That's not that cannot yeah. possibly be true, right? Or you go to a basketball game, like, we sell out every game, and there's 5,000 people in 20,000 seat arena. Well, why don't you sell out this one? But I think one thing, our teams are successful. They're truthful in their recruiting, so the kids and their families know what they're getting into, and we end up having less transfers, less disgruntled players, and just win more games and put kids in a position to play at the next level when you keep it real with them up front. And that's one thing our baseball guys do really well.
Yeah, it's tough competing with the Southern schools and you know, the more blue, like, I'll give you, like, even with basketball, like, you know, it's turned into a perennial top 25 program. I say perennial, like, if you do it for about a good 5 years, I think you earn the
right.
That's
fair. Yep.
To say, you know, it's become a pretty routine thing. Like, I don't see them going anywhere this year, like, from what I've heard. You know, I told you this the first time we spoke. Like, if I do support college basketball, it's usually Seton Hall, so I know a decent amount. You know, to do that in this area, I think is very impressive. And it just says a lot about, like you said, the authenticity, the job that guys like, Rob Shepard have done, just Kevin Willard, like you just look at it from top to bottom. Like it's a full effort to do it in this area because you are competing with a lot of schools in the South that have that reputation, the weather. It's more appealing to kids who want that quote unquote bigger feel. Like it's hard to do.
It is, man. I get, and those are two of my favorite coaches. You just said, I'm lucky to have worked with them for as long as I have. And they're great guys and great coaches. So I appreciate you shouting them out. So I didn't have to do it myself. But, one thing, New Jersey's a weird place, right? I'm a Jersey guy. I graduated from high school at Toms River East, and I moved around for about 10 years, got the job at Seton Hall in my late 20s, and I've been there for 15 years, right? Having moved away, I really like it here. Like, I have a daughter that's 5 years old. I want her to grow up a Jersey Shore kid, and that's where we live in Long Branch right now, right? But New Jersey's got this weird thing of, like, if you play sports in, let's say, Alabama or California or Florida, there's such a draw to staying in and being, Mr. Alabama or Mr. Florida in baseball, basketball, football, where you're kind of a rock star all through high school, and then you want to just be the best player at the big university in your state and then get a chance to play after that. And in Jersey, it's this weird thing of, like, everybody wants to get out. All the good players want to leave and not come to Rutgers, Seton Hall, Monmouth, whatever it might be. And I'm not saying you shouldn't get out and see the world. You definitely should. I'm thankful I got to do it. But I think the perception of New Jersey is this weird thing of, like, it's the armpit of America. It's a joke. It's a laughingstock. And kids want to get out. And I don't think they should to some extent. I think if you got a chance to be great at Rutgers, Seton Hall, Monmouth, a school like that, you should go ahead and do it and rep your state and help us get on the same level as some of the other states are.
Yeah, I could agree with you more. I don't know if it's like an Italian thing or what it is, but I'm with you. Like, just for me, it was like, I want to do the best I can to make my state, my hometown, like where I grew up, look good and contribute to the cause. And I think, football especially, we've lost. Yeah. Like, Rutgers was doing pretty well for, the 05, 06 up to, like, even when Flood got there for a couple of years. And then it just kind of fell off. And it looked like, we lost the battle when it came to keeping kids.
That's it. We lost. Yep.
And people don't understand. Like, I got into a conversation about this on Twitter a couple months ago. Like, I heard these coaches from California, and I want to say – maybe it was Texas, arguing about college football. And I was like, I just want to say one thing, guys. Like, I don't know if we could say top to bottom our state competes with you, but the Big North Conference in New Jersey, Don Bosco, Bergen Catholic, St. Joe's, those schools on St. Peter's, like those four or five, six schools will go out to any of these states and compete with your best teams. And I see it. They go out there at the beginning of each season and they do it. And it's like, you have to understand, if we could keep those kids in the state when it came to football and got them to Rutgers, we'd have a top 25 team every year.
Yeah, and what I would say, if you want to make that easy, go watch any ESPN major national college football or basketball game, right? And when they show you where the kids are from, there's kids out from New Jersey on almost every team, right? So if you just kept some of them in New Jersey, you'd think you would have a competitive program in both football and basketball. And that's been – largely our basketball recruiting is New York City and New Jersey. And it's kind of worked for the last couple of years. There's good players here, whether you like it or not, there's good players here. You just got to find a way to motivate them and keep them home and try to rep their home state and be a part of what's going on here.
Yeah. I think that's big. And I think we're starting to see it a little bit, but something hopefully that continues. So talk to me a little bit about, some of what you're doing with your, let's talk baseball particularly for now, because that is a lot of my listening base, is on the baseball side. If not strength conditioning, it's towards the baseball side as well. Give us a little bit of a background, I guess. Like, so you said 2005, did that coincide with when you began working with the baseball team as well? Or?
Yeah. I've been with, we've shuffled the staff a few times, been some coaching changes. But baseball is one of the teams I've been with for all 15 years. So that's been from day one with me. And it's a as far as the way we train, if you're doing college baseball is a weird animal. Obviously, this year is more different than normal years. But normally, the guys play summer ball, might be in New Jersey, might be in North Carolina, might be in Texas, could be anywhere, right? And they're playing almost like a pro schedule in the summer, like five, six games a week. They might have access to a gym. They might not, right? So they come in August. fairly detrained because they played 56 games in the spring with us, maybe more if we have a good year and go to the Big East Championship, right? Then they play right into, you know, another 60 games in the summer in about 90 days, something like that. And then we get them in September. When we get them in September, we train pretty hard, man. We do kind of like a – and you say on your Instagram profile, you're a meathead by meathead at heart. We do kind of like a Jersey meathead program in September and October. Try to put some mass on, work on our big lifts, try to get good at squatting, good at trap bar deadlift, good at the bench press for the position guys. And get the pitchers kind of back after pitching so many games all summer and get their bodies healthy and their shoulders and their rotator cuffs back where they should be. And try to, you know, they play about a month of fall ball in October, which is it's important to the guys that are trying to make the team. But that's when you try to learn new things, try new stuff. If you're a pitcher, you're throwing at a reduced capacity than usual. And then, you know, we send them home in December and January. That's pretty much our break. Hope they train at home. If they're the guys that are local and have a good amount of them, they'll train with me. Four days a week over that Christmas break, depending how the holidays fall. And then when we get back to school in January, we get 1 month to really get after it. We train, we lift, we condition, hit some plyo, stuff like that. And then from February until hopefully, you know, June, if we do well, we're playing a midweek game, three games every weekend. You got a biggie series every weekend. So we try to lift the position guys on Monday and Thursday. Monday after our road trip, we do a heavy day. We're going to do some kind of squat. We're going to do some kind of press, some kind of big pull. Then on Thursday before the series, after a midweek game, we're going to do our lighter stuff. So it might be lat pull downs, might be some dumbbell work, might be some kettlebell stuff, but something not to make them sore for those games on Friday, Saturday, Sunday that really matter. And we kind of keep that, and our pitchers lift around their schedule. So it's not, I'm not reinventing a wheel. It's kind of what every minor league organization does. If the kid's our Friday night starter, he throws on Friday. We get a total body lifting on Saturday most weeks. You know, Tuesday might be kind of a recovery day. Sunday might be kind of a recovery day. Monday, Tuesday, we'll lift again depending on his class schedule and the travel schedule. And then kind of get him ready to throw again the next Saturday. Or Friday in that case, I guess.
Yeah, you mentioned not reinventing the wheel. You know, you can really screw yourself up if you get way too domed up in your head about the schedule of lifting for pitchers, right?
Yeah. You really can. And I think to some extent, this is what I normally tell to when I present on this at conferences or whatever. I think you should have, and this is, I guess with baseball, I've had two periods in my career. I worked for a year before seeing off with the Pittsburgh Pirates. So before that, I had one way of looking at baseball. Then after spending a season with them, I sort of viewing it differently because that's what they're doing at the next level. And I think with pitchers, as a strength coach, this is just my opinion. It's not set in stone. You should have a general idea of what you think the week should look like for each of your pitchers, right? But then as you go through the season and talk to the guys and get to learn their body, and at a young age, they get to learn their body, maybe you got to make some changes. You know what I mean? If our Friday night guys is a great pitcher, good work ethic, and I can trust what he tells me, if he says he feels better, let's say split squatting on Monday, real squatting on Thursday, I'm willing to work with that at the college level. At the high school youth level, maybe you got to be a little more regimented in what you're doing. But I think a lot of it is, it's still for all the science and the research. We know it's a little bit of trial and error and accepting individual differences and allowing the guy to do what's going to make him feel good on when he gets on the mound and gets the ball in his hand.
Yeah. I think the biggest problem or issue, so I dealt with this a lot because I started working with NJCU this past year, pretty unconventional in the sense that like the D3 schools don't obviously have strength coaches, you know, on staff, which is very different. A lot of the schools don't even have these D3 schools don't even have a strength coach for any of their sports. You know, it's unfortunate, but usually it's like one of the coaches on staff running it. And they'd basically reached out and were like, hey, we want to actually use one of our, you know, assistant coach stipends on a coach with a strength training background. Like, would you be interested? Long story short, I ended up working with them and running their strength training for them. And the biggest issue I had was that they had an approach that was like very, you know, you saw the Tampa Bay Rays start to do it last year and it started to catch on. They used openers, right? So for me, it was like, shit, I have no idea who the hell's going to throw, what days they're going to throw.
Yeah.
I had to find a way to come up with like a balanced approach that was like, if they do something on this day and pitch later, they're going to be okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's important, man, because even with us, we have our starters are usually pretty much set in stone unless something, you know, goes wrong for one of the guys really bad. And then we might have a closer that's like our main closer for the year. But those middle relief guys can change day to day. You know what I mean? And we've had weekends where the same middle relief guy might go in Friday, Saturday, might go in Friday, Sunday. And it's real hard. And that's where what I was saying that before. I think you got to get to know the guys, get to know their bodies and trust what they're telling you a little bit because they're going through it. I think a lot of that stems from, I think baseball is a sport where kind of like the disciplinarian and the I'm a badass type strength coach doesn't work as well as maybe it does in football, wrestling, lacrosse, sports like that because these guys are different. They're playing, they're doing different things on the field. For the most part, just sweeping generalization, baseball guys like to lift. So I find if you talk to them about it and let them understand what's going on in their body, they'll be open to, can we try this? Can we do this? You know, as opposed to just everybody's doing the same cookie cutter thing every day. That's why I think places like yours kind of excel because you can deal with these kids so individualized in a way where my schedule and my day just doesn't allow me to do it.
Yeah, it is nice, you know, being able to zone in on one, you know, or two athletes at a given time and, you know, be a little more personal with it. I think, you know, and you could speak on this a little bit, you know, seeing or hearing someone talk about, you know, that team setting, it goes to really show you that, and I've talked about this before, a lot of individualization, you know, comes down to, you know, accounting for load, tracking load, the way you cue things. Like everyone always thinks it's like having 65 different exercises for every athlete. And it's like, well, no, it really does come down to like, a lot of them need similar things, but they need different amounts of it, or the load for it is going to be different. And I think that's one of the biggest things that comes down to individualization, at least for me, even with my athletes, when I'm programming for them separately, you know, they might need a lot of the same exercises, or they're going to end up just doing a lot of the same exercises, but it's like tracking the load on them, how they're doing it, the cues you're going to need. One may need one cue for it. One may need another. Like in my mind, that is where individualization really comes down to.
Agreed. And I think, you know, even if you're a pretty novice lifter, you understand the idea that even if we're just talking about a very basic barbell back squat, right? If we're both going to barbell back squat, but you're going to do 3 sets of 10 and I'm going to do 10 sets of 3 at whatever percent we're going to work at, we're doing a different thing physiologically. You would agree with that, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. It's the only thing that's the same is the variation. Yeah.
Right. And the problem that I run into with coaches, and you probably run into with parents, is if you don't have a trained eye and have never experienced the difference between, let's say for that example, 3 sets of 10 versus 10 sets of 3, you don't understand the difference. You know what I mean? And the one thing I think is the coaches that I've had issues with over the years are the ones that have never really trained themselves, right? Because they don't understand those subtle differences. They don't understand the difference between why one guy doing a high bar squat versus another guy doing a low bar squat versus another guy doing a box squat. To them, they just see squats, right? And you make these subtle differences, like you said, change volume and intensity and make a world of difference. And I find those are some of the hardest conversations to have if someone's never trained. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's really tough. Like, especially like the really, really, really good pitching coaches, like, damn, they're good, right? Mm-hmm. But it's like, you had a guy do a chin up? Oh my God. Like, but he's gonna spontaneously combust. Like,
I was in an argument, not an argument, but a conversation at 6 a.m. this morning, so less than 20 hours ago. One of our position guys was giving one of our pitchers a hard time because he didn't bench press, right? They were joking around. It was good natured. We're stretching. I'm into it. When guys get in, as long as it's not going to like spiral out of control to a fight, I'm good with guys kidding each other in the weight room. And the one guy was like, why don't you bench press? Aroldis Chapman bench presses. I saw it on his Instagram. Right. And I was like, all right, well, this kid is not Aroldis Chapman. He's a different guy. He's a different body type. But that being said, like, I think someone like Aroldis Chapman, I have no idea if he benched or not. I don't follow him on Instagram. But if he does, that's what works for his body type and his mechanics and his throwing style, where it might not work for one of our guys. Maybe our guys
and vice versa.
Push up. Exactly.
Well,
right.
Doesn't bench. Well, it's like, doesn't mean you couldn't get a benefit from it.
And what clear, 100% agree. Same thing with the chin-ups, man. Like, everybody should do, if you look at, like, from, you know, elementary school physical education, the pull-up is regarded as a good exercise for everybody, right? But then all of a sudden we decide, oh, you throw a baseball, so you should never do a chin-up again. Well, why? Do you not use the same back musculature and bicep that everybody else does? That doesn't make a ton of sense to me. The one thing I think that has made our job harder than ever before. And it's a blessing and a curse is the internet, right? Because we can, guys like me and you can go online and look at how everybody trains. We can see what the Yankees are doing. We can see what the Giants are doing. But we have the background to cipher through it and be like, okay, that's good. I can use that. I can use that. I wouldn't do that with my guys. But the problem is when people watch these IG feeds and these Twitters, you know, I sound like a real old man. I call it these Twitters. When people read these tweets, right, and don't have the context to this is what the Yankees do, this isn't what my Little League baseball team should do. If I told you how many times I had a conversation where like, oh, I saw Aaron Judge does this workout, so my 8-year-old's going to start doing it. It's like, well, no, that's not at all what you should do. Like, even if that's really Aaron Judge's workout, he's a monster of a human being, a grown man that's reached he's done growing, he's mature, and he's a 1% of a 1% of what we have on the planet athletically. Your 8th grader probably shouldn't train like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough when you make blanket assumptions based on different things. It just gets really difficult, and I think that's the biggest thing to explain to people. You know, and it's not always like, especially in baseball with lifting in particular, like the way things are done have evolved and changed so much in a short amount of time. Like the words, we didn't do it, we did it this way, or we didn't do it this way in the 80s, 90s, or even early 2000s shouldn't really be a basis of an argument when it comes to strength training and lift and baseball.
Yeah, I agree with that with pretty much all sports, right? I think if you look at strength and conditioning, there's some stuff that is probably going to be done forever, right? I think some variation of a squat is going to be valuable 1,000 years from now, right? Some variation of a hip hinge and a pull, like that stuff's not going anywhere. But as far as the actual implementation of a program, it changes. It changes a lot. Like, look at the amount of information that comes out between, you know, good quality university-funded research that the NCAA puts out and other organizations to just what guys are posting on the internet. It just changes so much. And I'm so confused by people that are like, well, when I played, I did blank, and are not willing to say, like, number one, the science, everything's changed since then. And number two, this person that we're talking about isn't you. So why don't you step back, stop telling me what you did when you were hot in the 90s, and let me explain to you what we can do to help this person now in 2020. And I'm in that conversation more than I would like. And I'm sure you are too. I just wish you're all a little more progressive minded about what's going on in the field.
Yeah, I mean, and that same end too, like, what if you, I mean, I'm sure in 15 years there has to have been a lot of things. Like, I had this conversation with an athlete before. I mean, it still happens today, but they were like, yeah, coach, you'd be, they were like, they just got into their sophomore year of high school. They're like, yeah, coach, you'd be surprised, like, what the, you know, kids are doing when they get to the field. Like, I'm doing the warm-up we do here when I train to get ready. And, like, some of these kids literally just, like, put their cleats on and get out to the field and, like, put their arm across their – you should pull their arm across their chest.
Yeah, old school phys ed style stretch, right?
Like, and it's like, touch your toes and if they do that and then they pick up the ball and they start throwing. And I was like, dude, like, now more and more kids are realizing that's wrong. When I played, like, I'm talking – I graduated high school in 2012, right? Okay. I'm pretty young. I'm 26. And I would get to the field when I was 16 years old. I would walk into the dugout, put my bag down, throw my cleats on, walk out to the outfield, and throw. And I would go play. And I'm like, that blows my mind that that was accepted.
Right.
And it's like now, yeah, is it still happening a little bit? Sure. But like, look at all these kids that are like, oh, that's crazy they're doing that, because they know. And like, that is only in the matter of like, you know, 9 years that changed. So let me ask you this. You start out in 05 at Seton Hall. Now it's 2020. What things have been the biggest that you've seen in terms of what's changed with what not only are you doing with just strength conditioning in general, but baseball players?
Okay. The biggest thing that I've seen change, I think it's might because you recruit a lot of New Jersey kids in from 2005 to let's say 2010, a lot of our kids either had never lifted before or they lifted like in the basement with their older brother and they benched and curled, right?
Yes. Nothing wrong with that.
Dude, I don't hate that. If you want to look good on the beach in Belmar, you should absolutely do that. That's a great way to get started strength training. Now, if you want to play baseball at a high level or no sport at a high level, you got to probably, you would agree that's not the way to keep training. You know what I mean? So they came in just a very low training age. A lot of the kids we have now have more experience with people like yourself and have done – you know, extensive dynamic warm-ups, have done some variation of Olympic lifts, have done kettlebell work already, have done, you know, shoulder stabilization work and rotator cuff work already. And as a credit to what you guys are doing in the private sector, kids come in with a much higher training age than they did 10 or 15 years ago, right? That's a positive. The one possible negative is some of you guys do such a good job, they don't want to deviate from what they've been doing work for them in high school. So I kind of, whenever that happens, I try to sit the person down and just kind of say, look, what you were doing was great when you played 25 games a year. Here we're playing 56. Your lifestyle is going to be drastically different. I need you to trust me, and I'll do everything I can to do right by you, but we're going to take this journey together. And if there's something we're doing that I tell kids from day one, we're going to work hard. We're going to get after it. But if something hurts, if something doesn't feel right, I'm open. My door's open. Come and talk to me whenever you want, and we'll figure out a way to get around this. But that's probably the biggest thing. The training age has changed a lot that I'm getting kids at. And then I think when I got there in 05, you're still kind of an old school, kind of like power, you gotta be as strong as possible, right? Then it veered into all the functional training stuff. You don't have to lift weights. You just need six-pound medicine
ball.
Even in baseball,
that was when people were like, oh, get strong. Like that was like the.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not sure if that's because we had so many Jersey guys that were just kind of grew up. I'm saying this with all respect, because this is how I grew up, being a Guido meathead. And that's my world too. But that's kind of where they were then. Then it got like super the other side of I'm going to do single leg squats on a balance board with a ball, a Bosu ball over my head kind of thing. You don't need to squat as long as you could do lunges on a plyo ball. You're okay kind of thing. And now I think it's in a better spot where it's kind of back in the middle, right? Like we need the squat, we need the deadlift, we need the bench, but then we can also do proprioceptive work on our flexibility and kind of get it on both sides.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I feel like a lot of people would look at, you know, the landscape of strength training in baseball. Like I'm never going to name names. I don't want to do that to people. But like I have athletes that were like, oh, I'm going to my pitching guy, you know, before we started lifting, like, you know, we started coming to me to train as a sophomore, you know, his strength training base was done after this quote unquote comprehensive, you know, pitching strength training program that went along with the throwing they were doing every week during the winter to get ready for the season. And it was like, yeah, we'll throw bullpens and then we do like the upper back series. Right. And then like we'll do, you know, some running. And it's like that is the entirety of what they thought they should be doing for strength training. And I remember like back at, you know, and I'm saying it, I'm not disparaging this organization. I'm going to say who they are because like I had a good experience there. But, you know, I'm playing for the Jack Cuss Diamond Jacks back in 2010, and this is like a state-of-the-art baseball program in New Jersey for club ball. And our pitching program, while they did a really good job with the pitching end of things, the physical part of it was like get done with your pen during the winter, you'd go for practice, and you run a couple laps around the dome and then do some rice buckets. Like for right. those who don't know, you put your hand inside a bucket of rice and just try to move it around and squish it around, and that's your forearm work, and that was it. And it's like,
yeah,
it blows my mind that was the entirety of it, even just 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think that comes into a couple things. One, these pitching programs, these high schools, these travel teams, there's only so many hours in a day, and you only got the kids with you for so many hours. So I think they place a premium on pitching, of actually throwing and watching the kids throw and working on their technique, which I totally understand. But I think you get a better result when you're with your pitching coach, you do your pitching work, right? And then at another time in the week, you go to a strength coach and lift weights and get bigger, stronger, faster, more velocity, that kind of stuff, right? I think we both agree on that. The other thing that I see that I've seen a lot is in my opinion, and I'm a little old school in this, a lot of the best strength training is really the basics, right? And I think what happens in our society today is it's hard to sell the basics. It's hard to tell a kid, okay, there's not a magic wand. There's a squat rack. There's a couple basic exercises that you need to get really good at, and it's going to be hard, and it's going to be grueling, and it's going to actually get stronger and put mass on your frame is going to take a lot of time and effort. And that's a hard sell to a lot of people, right? So I think what happens is we don't want to, you know, we don't want to sell that to people. So instead, we start selling these other things that are easier, and maybe the parents with the kids haven't seen before, and now we put the bells and whistles on. And we're like, oh, this is the newest, best thing ever. This is a scapular stabilizer exercise that you can maybe get the same effect from doing a dumbbell bench, but you can't sell a dumbbell bench because the family thinks they can do that in a gold gym without your help. So I think what's happened is we keep trying to be better and reinvent the wheel all the time. And the thing I was going to say before about social media, one thing I think the social media world is lacking is it's always showing these crazy accomplishments, right? We see a football player jump on a 60-inch box. We see a guy run an agility drill faster than everybody run it before. But nobody posts about just the consistency and the mundaneness of doing a great dynamic warm-up every time they train, right? We always see that the celebration after a touchdown. We never see the post-game cool down and recovery stuff they're doing until you're ready to practice the next day. And I wish we saw more of that, man, because that's stuff that's boring and not fun to watch. To me, that's where the real progress happens, right? The games are awesome. The guy jumping on the crazy plyo box is awesome. But let's look at all the stuff he did before and after that to keep his body ready and injury-free and to be able to do that thing for the 30-second Instagram clip.
Yeah, that's a big thing too. Like, what you see in that small little window of social media isn't the whole picture, and you have to make sure you remember that.
Yeah, man. Like, one thing I always talk about our baseball guys do, and this is the majority of our teams at Seton Hall, but I think it's showcased the best of baseball. They don't do anything that groundbreaking, right? I'm proud of the programs I write for them. I put them up against any other, you know, baseball team's program in the country, but I think what we do is we kill it with consistency. We don't miss workouts. We don't take days off. The culture is such that if a guy's having a down day and doesn't want to give 100%, I can either get after him. Their coaches come to the lift, or their captains get after him, where it's really hard to have a bad day. And we just do those simple – it's a cliche, but we do the simple things to the highest level we can day in and day out. And I think that's one thing that if you do that, you'll see results, right? I've never seen anybody – give 100% of themselves to a program and do it as good as they could every single day and not see some kind of results. And to me, that's kind of like always the best and worst thing about our profession, is that if you work hard at a bad program, you'll probably get better results than if you don't work hard at a good program, right? As long as you don't get injured. And that's always a kind of frustrating thing, because guys like me and you, like, we read so much, we present, we write, we have books, we have, you know, high level presentations. And then at the same time, if you didn't do any of that stuff and just worked hard at the very bare minimum basics, you would still see some kind of improvement. Now, hopefully not as much improvement as stuff we're doing, but, you know, human body responds to change in stimulus, whether they're optimal or not. So I think that's one thing that's always frustrated me for the 20 plus years I've been in this, is that the body responds to any kind of stimulus, but we're just searching for that one thing that makes us 1 or 2% better than what the other guy is doing.
Yeah. The consistency part you mentioned is a big key. You know, say it all the time, obviously, without proper execution, good execution and consistency, even a bad program will get something accomplished. Put them all together, it's obviously the most ideal scenario. But, you know, if you could have the best coaching, the best coach, the best program, and if you're struggling to get in the facility once a week, even consistently, you're going to not get much. You know, take an average program with an average coach, but it's 3 to 4 times a week consistently for 6 straight months, you're going to be cooking with something. You know, like that's
you know required. What which really proved that to me in the last 10 years is CrossFit, right? I'm not a huge advocate of CrossFit. I started about a year ago, I decided I wanted to learn more about it. So I just started taking trial sessions at any place that offered a free trial session, right? And as a strength and conditioning coach, you can pick apart that program endlessly, right? They do this wrong, they do that wrong, they don't coach that correct. There's all kinds of problems with it, right? But what they do incredibly well is they create an environment where people want to be there and train. They make it a cool social experience where if you don't show up to your group kind of gives you a hard time about it, and they get people to work hard. And if you do those 2 or 3 things, you're going to be very successful. I mean, that's part of like the story of CrossFit. I don't think it's much about the programming and the sets and reps, and more about the social side of it. Of they made it cool to go to a gym with people you know from the gym and just kill yourself a couple times a week, right? Now, whether or not there's long-term injuries, overuse stuff, all that, we can argue that. But they kind of prove that even with most strength coaches consider a subpar program, with hard work and consistency, you're going to see some kind of results. And I don't know if you really argue that, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think that's a big thing with kids too. Like, I see it in the private sector when you're dealing with high school kids, let's just say, like, they want the quick results really fast. Some of them don't want to put the work in. You have to be enamored with the process. Like, you know, you have to look forward to going in every day and doing a sprint, doing your recovery, doing your work, like understanding that it all builds up into that like crescendo of the results are where I want them to be. Like, that's not going to just kind of pop up after a couple of weeks. Like, I had a kid one time, you know, come in for, you know, a couple months, he would miss you know, a couple sessions each week. And then if he showed up, he would do a couple things and then sit in the corner and hang out or whatever. And it was like, you know, if he could put every single exercise he ever did on social media, he would never miss an exercise.
Right.
You know, the only stuff he wanted to publicize, it was like, you know, you see this in football a lot. I hate the stereotype, but I see it in football all the time. You know, the go out to the field shirtless and sweat and then get a picture of you doing like quick feet drills through a ladder and throw it up on Instagram and say, I'm built different though. And just you make your Instagram caption and it's like, dude, you didn't do shit today. I know you didn't do work. Like, stop pretending. And I see that all the time. It's like the image is more important to them. And you're just not going to succeed if you have that mentality. And that's like the reason for what you do.
Yeah, man, I agree. And I'm for someone my age, I'm pretty into social media and the internet. I don't blame people for trying to get as many eyes on them as they can, especially in my opinion. From a business perspective, I know your podcast is about business too. If you're a football player and your career is statistically going to be extremely short, right? The NFL stands for not for long, to use a cliche. If you're not trying to make yourself as famous as you can and get as many endorsement deals and as much money as you possibly can for those couple years, when your body's going to be destroyed at the end of it and possibly your brain's going to be destroyed at the end of it, you're a fool. I don't care what anybody says. If you're not trying to eat for the rest of your life after a couple years in the NFL, you're not doing it right, in my opinion. So if that means you got to be Odell Beckham with dyed hair and always, you know, on the yacht with dancers and champagne bottles and always have the freshest Supreme outfit and the best Jordans to get on all the fashion blocks, I get it. I understand that. But give me something in between that of, yeah, I got the sickest Travis Scott sneakers, but I'm working out in them. You know what I mean? Or like, yeah, I was partying last night at the club, but I'm going to wake up and eat a healthy breakfast. I'd like to see more of that from some of those guys. But I don't begrudge anybody for trying to get, you know, internet famous in 2020. I just think you got to, you know, mix the bad stuff in with a good message. You know what I mean? Like, we all like birthday cake, but you need a salad sometimes too.
Yeah. It's like, what are the core things that are going to be there to support, you know, what you need, you know, at the end of the day, and what are the most important? And sometimes that stuff isn't what's going to get the most views, you know, on social media and things like that. And I think, you know, the more we explain to these kids the importance of this consistency and, like, you know, they're just wasting their time. If they're in the private sector, they're wasting their parents' money. You know, if they are really talented and get a scholarship to a Division I school like you're at, you know, and they don't do the right things, they're wasting that opportunity because of the talent they have. Like, that is just something that's just really big to understand. And I think, you know, people like us can sympathize with the idea of maybe not, you know, having exposure to some of these things and maybe like, what could we have done or what could we have been as athletes? Like, I look at it all the time, you know, being a kid that was, you know, fortunate enough to be just be born with a strong arm, throwing, you know, mid to upper 80s in high school. Like, what could that have been if I had some of what these kids have? You know, it would have been insane, you know? And I think understanding that makes me realize like the importance of telling these kids how fortunate they are to have, you know, high level training and what it could do for their athletics.
Yeah, man. I think we're seeing it now, like younger kids getting it younger, is hopefully having a good effect on the rest of their career and the rest of their life. And like you said, when I got in this field, I was very lucky. I went to a public high school in Tom's River, New Jersey, with a strength coach there. His name was Ron DeVito. He's still the best coach I've ever had or ever worked with. But like that changed my life, right? Because that put me on this career path. It got me involved in powerlifting at a very young age, then Olympic lifting. And I just really, like, I loved the weight room and the environment. And I loved pushing my body to get better. And a lot, if I wouldn't have had that weight room and that strength coach and Coach Ron DeVito, I would have had a completely different career path, completely different life to some extent. And I think getting exposed to that young was really instrumental to me. And I think kids getting exposed to it young is super important now.
Yeah. That's the thing too. Like, it is becoming something that's more accepted and more popular even at a younger age. Back, you know, as the years go by, I think the access, the accessibility to it is just greater. Yeah. You know, and I think that's just, you know, a nature of, it starts at the top in some instances, because it does work from the bottom up at other points too. But, you know, you see the younger kids really starting to get exposed to more stuff. And I think a lot of that also comes from, you know, adults seeing the importance of it and like making sure that, you know, professionals are in schools and in high schools and stuff like that. Like, that's huge.
Yeah, man. I think we're part of the first generation now. So let's say the people that are like 50, 50 to 60, and they have high school kids right now. They're the first generation to really commit to training through middle age, right? Like, they're going to CrossFit. They own a Peloton. They go to SoulCycle. So they realize the importance of taking care of your body in a way their parents probably didn't. You know what I mean? In the way my parents were not super into working out at all, really. I'm like in that middle age group. Whereas now, like, even if I wasn't a strength and conditioning coach, I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I'm trying to make her love physical activity from a young age, right? And I think that's just kind of the world is kind of shifting in that direction because of this is the first generation of like lifelong workout people are now having high school age kids, and it opens the door for private facilities and different workout class, stuff like that, to work with these younger kids. The one thing I always say is the more I've been in this profession, and I spent a lot of time around, you know, either elite or close to elite Division I athletes, I think in America we make one mistake, and I teach this in my undergrad classes all the time. We take kids in like 6th, 7th grade, pin them as athletes, the top 1%, that are going to be able to play travel ball, go to the big time football camps, wrestle at a high level, and we give them all the attention, all the instruction, all the training. You can argue too much training, right? You can argue like year-round baseball isn't good for a 13-year-old. But then we take the other 99% and don't give them any attention, any instruction, right? So we have this situation where by 25, so many people are overweight, obese, hypertension, type 2 diabetes. And my thing is, why don't we spend more time addressing the other 99% of the people out there that maybe you're never going to play Division I baseball, but you also don't have to be on your way to my 600-pound life by the time you're 25. And I think that as I've gotten older, as much as I love what I do with our student athletes, I've kind of my worldview got a little bigger of like, I want to try to help these other kids that are getting ignored by their coaches and their gym teachers and stuff like that. Because I think as a society, if you look at the numbers on our obesity and our stuff, it's so bad. I want to be a part of fixing that problem in some capacity.
Yeah, for sure. I think you mentioned a good point too. Like when I was growing up, I was lucky enough that my dad had a, you know, big interest in strength training and lifting, more like on the bodybuilding side. And, you know, that was more rare in that generation. So when I was growing up, the knowledge that I had about lifting from him and what I was doing at home and training was rare, that like I would see kids and it wasn't a common thing for them, you know, to be like, oh, my dad does that too, or I'm doing that stuff with my dad as well. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's like every kid you talk to is like, oh, we have a weight training set at home. My dad used to train a little bit. Like it's more, like you said, common. And now think about it when that generation gets a little older, every kid's going to have that experience. Like I think of my son like someday, and I actually thought about this the other day, you know, am I going to be in the dynamic sometime where my, you know, son or daughter maybe goes to college or high school or, you know, even in middle school, they get a trainer, and I'm going to look and say like, man, it's going to be hard to butt out from this. It's like, you know, Bill Belichick's kid going to play football, right? Or like a coach. Yeah. And you're like, damn, they're not doing the right things. Like I'm pretty knowledgeable in this field. Like, you know, I know what I'm doing. Like I got to sit by and watch that. It's like, I think about that sometimes, like, what's that going to be like? You see your daughter, you know, she's 12, 13, 14 years old. And they, you know, whatever sport she's playing, they get a strength coach and they're not doing the right stuff. You're going to go in and say, I want my daughter doing this stuff. Like, I know what she's supposed to be doing. Oh, really? You know? It's like, oh, yeah, I'm this person. I do this. Like, I do this for a living. It's like, oh, okay. Maybe you do know.
You know, yeah, you know what's funny about that, man? She's 5. So she's at the very beginning of sports. She likes rec league soccer. She likes gymnastics a lot. And it's at a very fun recreational level right now. And my attitude, and I say this in every podcast I'm on, if when she's 18 years old, she's playing all-state soccer and sitting on a national letter of intent to play soccer at Rutgers, I'll be in the front row cheering her on to score a goal, right? If at 18 she's in a punk rock band at the Stone Pony, I'll be in the front row for that, cheering for her to hit every chord and note she's trying to play and sing. That's the kind of dad I am, right? But one thing about like stepping in, I go out of my way to, when I go to her soccer stuff, not to wear any Seton Hall gear. Like I'll change it before I go and just put on regular guy clothes, because it's weird, man. I don't really want to have those conversations. My thing is, if that coach is telling these kids to do X on a soccer field, that's that coach's job. And if I saw something that was dangerous, yeah, I sit there now and say I would run practice different. But like, I'm not, number one, I'm not a soccer coach, so who do I think I am? And number two, I don't want to be that dad. Like, I don't want to be in a conversation every 30 seconds of, well, what do you think about this? Should my 8-year-old be squatting heavy yet? I want to enjoy being a dad more than being a strength coach on that side. Now, if she gets to high school and she, you know, there's a chance she could play beyond that, maybe things change a little bit. But I want to keep it just as fun for her and her loving run around her friends for as long as I can.
Yeah, that's a good point. I even look at it sometimes like, oh, I want to crawl into a hole when like fitness or strength training type conversation starts to occur when I'm just out like around my friends or like their families or my family even. Like people start to give these opinions, and one, sometimes you have to just bite your own tongue and listen to them even though they're wrong. Or two, they want to just like, oh, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? And like, you know, they're not going to. You know, they're not going to expect what you have to say because, like, odds are they have a, you know, misconception of what it actually is. And it's like, man, sometimes I'm like, I just want to stay the hell out of it. Like, just leave me the hell out of it. You have your conversation. Like, I don't want to be involved in it whatsoever. Yeah. I'm sure, like, you know, I would look at it the same way as, you know, if I had a son, let's just say, that played baseball someday. It's like, oh, like, you know a lot about baseball. You train baseball players, strength train them, and you know a lot of baseball coaches, whatever. What do you think about my son? Could you connect him with somebody? It's like, I want to just be left the hell out of that. Like, leave me alone and, you know, whatever. And I think that is an interesting dynamic, too. Like, I thought about that before just working with some young athletes. Like, I wonder what it's going to be like for me when I have a son or daughter that's at that age. Like, I hope I do have the willpower to just shut up and leave it alone.
Yeah, man, those family conversations are tough too, because you start having conversations with cousins, aunts, and uncles of, well, I've been doing X, Y, Z. And it's, the way I handle that, honestly, is I say, do you like what you're doing now? Yeah. You feel like getting results? Yeah. Stick with it. Stay with it till you get bored of it. Then think about something else. But my, you know, like you said, a lot of times I think those casual kind of like dinner or drinks conversations, it seems like the average person doesn't want to hear what a guy like me or you really has to say about it anyway, because we can go so in depth on it.
Yeah.
So I try to keep it just light and casual.
Or they're very arrogant. They think they know more than, like, I remember being at Thanksgiving a couple years ago and having this, like, I think it was an aunt had a friend or something come over for Thanksgiving. It was a weird situation, but basically just like going on and on about like what she was doing for her training and how what she did was the best, and telling like during the conversation at the table, just like, oh, to me, you should try it, or this is the best way to do it. Like, you don't know who I am or what I do. Like, that's what I do for a living. And I didn't want to come across like that, but it's like, just shut up. Like, that's like, you know, talking about the stock market, and then you don't know you have like a, you know, elite level broker sitting across the table from you. It's, and like, I probably sound pretty stupid to their level of knowledge.
And don't you feel like we work in one of the only professions where everybody thinks they know how to do what we do? Like, I wouldn't think of sitting at a table with a stockbroker and telling him that I just bought $400 of some stock that I think is about to blow up, because he ain't working on that level. The way we're not working on the level of a you know, 50-year-old person that just signed up for CrossFit and doesn't know if they like it or not yet. So I always think it's like it's really just apples and oranges. But we work in the one profession where everybody thinks they know what we do. In a way that I just respect other professions more, I guess, where I will not be that person that tells someone that's been doing something for 20 years how to do it.
Yeah. It's tough. And I'm glad the conversation took this turn, because I don't really talk about this too often, but, you know, I just feel like what we do is one of the most misunderstood things by average people in terms of professions.
Yeah, and I think the problem is a couple. One, we're still real early on it, right? Even I guess the NSCA came around in the 80s.
I know, I agree with you. In 200 years, 300 years, we'll be long gone. They'll look back, and this will still be grouped in with what we think is early 50 years ago, will be grouped in with what we're doing right now. We're still being called early on.
Yeah, I agree. We're still super early on it from two perspectives. One, what we really understand about the body, right, and how it can train different modalities and stuff like that. And number two, just whatever I think is the idea of a strength coach is, so there's, if you think about our, there's not that many strength coaches in the United States compared to other professions, right? So it's like, if you tell somebody you're a strength coach, they might think you're a personal trainer. They might think you're an athletic trainer, that there's an injury. You know, there's so many things that they don't understand what we do. And then as a profession, I don't think we do a great job of marketing ourselves, right? Like, I don't think the way anyone can get certified as a strength coach or personal trainer with almost no experience or academic background in the field helps our profession. I just don't think it does, right? I think the idea that you could be a stockbroker during the day and in a weekend have a certificate that lets you train people is good for the perception of what we do. I don't think I'll ever change my stance on that. And I don't think the fact that there's so many, like I don't know how to call them, like, but people that are bad at what we do that become famous on social media. Only that helps either. And then the one thing I think we kind of failed as a profession so far is that we're not in any kind of union. There's no job security. Even at the college level during COVID-19, you could get furloughed, you could get laid off, your facility closed down, and you pay these organizations all this money for continuing education, and they don't have your back at all when that happens. So I think as a profession, we got a long way to go. I hope I got another 20 years in it and I can, see it change better, be a part of the change. Somebody your age, you might be doing this another 40 years. You definitely should be a part of it, of a change for the better. But it's a great job. It's fun. It's being around young people. It's working hard, helping people get better. But there's definitely a ways for it to go as far as a career and a profession, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm excited to see where it goes. And I think, again, it's going to be something cool. Like, being in this field at this time right now at a young age, that I'll see how it is now, but then I'll also see how it is in 30 years and just be able to contribute to that in some capacity is just really cool and definitely something I'm excited for. To kind of wrap things up, ending things a little bit, just giving you the opportunity, if you had anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't get to, or any closing thoughts on what we did talk about, I like to always give this opportunity to the guests, so the floor is yours.
Great, man. I had a great time with this. Great conversation about baseball and about kids staying home and playing for schools in New Jersey. And that's a big, important thing if schools like Seton Hall and Rutgers are going to continue to get better. The one thing I want to talk about for 1 second and shout it out, because is how we met, how I did with the NCAA conference presentation on. I'm doing a book with Bloomsbury Publishing next year. It should have been this year, but the coronavirus pushed it back. And it's about resistance training for endurance athletes. And why I wrote that with my co-author, Richard Borders, is that information is really not out there, right? You talk to a typical cross-country kid, typical distance swimmer, typical adult triathlete, they kind of vaguely know they should lift. They don't really know what they should do once they get in the weight room, right? And I want to try to change that. So we wrote a book about how that should look and how it should work. Both of us are competitive endurance athletes. My background is in powerlifting and Olympic lifting. Once I hit 30, I got into marathons and half marathons and stuff like that. Just caught the bug. And I want to try to get that information out there, that if you're a marathon runner, there are some benefits you could get from lifting weights and being stronger and having a more structurally sound body. And I want to help people do that. And the other thing, I know your podcast is Muscles and Management. I always say for the management and the business side of that, if you're in the private sector and you're not courting those endurance athletes, I think you're dropping the ball demographic-wise, because they're sweeping generalization. They're financially independent adults that care about training and want to get better at marathons, triathlons, tough mudders, stuff like that. So I think that's a big demographic that goes ignored by our profession. Where if you guys, do that right and market yourselves to them, I think that's a whole nother untapped market you guys should try to get. Not you personally, but our profession should try to get into.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on that. I have an athlete or an athlete. I have, well, he is an athlete because he competes in Ironman competitions. But yeah, he has noticed a big improvement in what he does with his long distance work just because of his, strength gains and speed increases and things like that. And that's something that people need to realize for sure. I think that's a great point that you bring up. Like, don't be shy away from those types of people because, you think that they run or they do things differently than we do, because what we do can offer a lot of benefit to them. So I think that's a good, a very good point for sure. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. This was excellent and a really good time. And, obviously look forward to talking to you more soon and hopefully we'll run it back again on here sometime. But thank you again for your time. I appreciate it.
Hey, man, I really appreciate that. I just want to keep everybody in the loop. If you see me running, I'm still a strength coach. I got headphones on, but best believe it's playing some Jersey Techno EDM while I'm running. And when I get back, I'm doing some squats and some bench presses and pull-ups because strength and conditioning is important. Thanks a lot, man.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DeFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.